John Condelis, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and I'm involved in directing the Grasslipper Biophotonics Center, which is a biophotonics, biophysical approach to the study of living matter by interacting matter with photons.
Well, at the workshop at ASU, you were talking about metastases and the metastatic process, and you had some very original thoughts on that. Can you tell me, in a very brief summary, what did you say?
Yeah, briefly, I think the insight that comes from the work that we've been doing on looking at tumor behavior at very high resolution has led us to the conclusion that the ability of tumor cells to actually break free of and then migrate within and then leave the primary tumor is just a re-expression of their embryonic morphogenetic patterns. So in this sense, tumor metastasis is really embryonic morphogenesis replayed.
Now, how do you make that connection?
By looking at the behavior of tumor cells at single cell resolution in live animals, not dead biology, where you're actually looking at tissue sections or you're looking at pieces of tissue that have been removed from the mouse. Rather, you're looking at the behavior of the tumor cells while they're inside the living animal, inside the living tumor, neither of which that have been dissected, and you're doing it in real time and at single cell resolution. Those four components are very rare capabilities, and that's where these very exotic microscope technologies become really important.
Right, well, there's a number of issues there I'd like to speak to you about. Let's start off with the very clever technology that you're using.
Yes.
So what are you doing exactly, and how are you actually studying this process in live animals?
Well, I think the biological problem, that is the study of single-cell behavior in real time in a live animal at single-cell resolution, requires special kinds of imaging microscopes. You can't use ultrasound, MR, PET, CT, any of the standard imaging technologies that are used with solid tissue because the resolution is not sufficient. But if you can figure out a way to get photons into solid tissue and then form images with them, you can generate the kinds of resolution that are required to see single cells and to see subcellular structures within those single cells. And so our whole attention then became shifted to accomplish those goals toward using optical microscopy. And obviously you can't use visible light because solid tissue is opaque to visible light. So one is forced to go out into the far red. And if you get out far enough into the far red, you can no longer excite fluorescent molecules because you're so far out. So how far out is that? 1,000 nanometers? Or 1,500 nanometers compared to visible light, which is around 450 to 550 nanometers. So you're at least two to almost three times a longer wavelength. So how do you excite these fluors? So what you do is you collide two photons simultaneously and take advantage of a nonlinear quantum mechanical phenomenon called multiphoton excitation. So if we can bring two photons to interact simultaneously with a chromophore that usually excites at 500 nanometers, we can put in two 1,000 nanometer photons and get the same event. Now, the tissue is transparent to a 1,000 nanometer photon. So now we can excite the 500 nanometer fluorescent protein with a photon that is completely passed by the tissue. And this allows us now to do the imaging. So this is why multiphoton microscopes have really become essential tools in doing these kinds of studies in vivo.
And I think you're actually doing this in mice, is that right?
You're doing this in mice, but it's also possible to do it in human tissue that's been removed from patients in the operating room. So we can take that tissue and look at it immediately, or better yet, we can implant it into the mammary gland if it's breast tissue. We can implant it to the mammary gland of an immunosuppressed mouse, and that mouse will then host that tissue. And that human tissue can then be imaged for some weeks.
And so you'd be watching what was happening to individual cells and the tumors.
Yeah, we're watching what's happening to individual cells. And the next surprise was, well, we thought we would just be looking at tumor cells because, after all, they're the cells that are generating the tumor mass and then spreading the disease. Turned out that the real action is the interaction between tumor cells and non-tumor cells. And if you don't have that interaction, the tumor cells are not actually very dangerous at all.
Because I was just reading from your presentation, macrophages are involved.
Yeah, so it turns out that the macrophages, which are supposed to be suppressing tumor growth and tumor cell migration and all of these things, because they're immune cells that attack non-self. So if a tumor cell mutates to the point where it's recognized as non-self, macrophages will simply eat it. And so for many years, people thought that these large macrophage infiltrations that were seen in solid tumors in people were the body's response to these tumors, and the immune system was trying to kill the tumor. Turns out that that's not true. What's going on is the macrophages are invading the tumor because they're being asked to come there by the tumor cells. And what the tumor cells are then doing is they're forming pairs with these macrophages. They're pairing up. It's a buddy system. And these pairs of cells then go on to stimulate each other to form morphogenetic fields. And these morphogenetic fields recapitulate what one sees in a normal developing breast. That was a big surprise. So the stromal cells are actually participating with the tumor cells to reconstruct a morphogenetic pattern.
And what is making these macrophages, the protective cells, go rogue and actually collude with the cancer cells?
Well, they're not going rogue. It turns out that what they're doing is they're precisely repeating a normal pattern of gene expression that they're hardwired to express when they're triggered just in the right way. How do we know that? Okay, so you could take a step back and say, how can you say any of this with any certainty? Well, we can say this with some certainty because we've watched morphogenesis in normal breast tissue in developing mice. And there's also a lot of histology of normal human breast as it undergoes its normal developmental cycles. So if you put all of this information together, plus the live imaging during mouse development in the mammary gland, you begin to realize that what's going on is the normal epithelial cells, one of their great tasks in morphogenesis is to invade the mammary fat pad. So these epithelial cells are inherently invasive, and they have to be able to invade and migrate long distances. The macrophages that they recruit actually help them do this. And this is what we see being repeated in the breast tumor. It's not a rogue issue at all. It's actually a reawakening of a perfectly normal issue that these cells have to face.
Okay, so the macrophages were absolutely essential in helping form the breast in the first place, and then they go on and fulfill other roles, do they?
And they go on and fulfill other roles in the adult, but what happens is when a breast tumor, or actually potentially any solid epithelially derived tumor, begins to grow in normal tissue, that tumor generates microenvironments or patterns of cytokine signaling that are not normally seen in normal tissue. And in some cases, what appears to be the case is that these signaling patterns that get set up were actually last seen in the embryo. And at some point, you achieve just the right amount of that signaling, and now these macrophages, which are normally present, or in other cell types, other stromal cells that are normally present in the tissue, go from being stromal cells that support the normal adult gland to switching their gene expression pattern to becoming embryonic versions of themselves. And then they support the morphogenesis of the epithelial cells, which now, in this case, are tumor cells instead of normal epithelial cells. So another way to say that, a shorthand way to say that, is the microenvironment of the tumor basically generates signals that reawaken these patterns of morphogenesis.
Is there any way that that could be used in some form of treatment, do you think? Way of changing the macrophages?
Yeah, so that's the inspiration that one can act on. Having made this realization and connection, you can go, well, you know, ordinarily, if you are trying to kill or attack in some way or suppress the behavior, let's say, the spreading of an epithelial cell, which is now a tumor cell, you're trying to suppress that tumor cell from spreading. What could you possibly use to do that that would not also affect other cell types in the body? Because after all, these are epithelial cells. They were normal cells just a few generations ago. And it's really a formidable problem. How do you do that? And in fact, nobody can do that. There's no drug company that's made a drug that's specific for spreading tumor cells. In fact, most of the drugs that are currently available have very low specificity in that regard. When you poison the tissue, yes, you poison the tumor cells, but you also poison the normal cells in the surroundings and other organ systems as well. So that's the great problem with cytotoxic drugs. So how can you possibly use this insight we just talked about to address a novel therapeutic approach? Well, the inspiration is that, hey, the cells that are actually spreading think they're embryonic. So is there something about embryonic cells that distinguishes them from their adult counterparts? And if those characteristics are absolutely unique to the embryonic state, those become targets that are highly selective for the tumor cells that think they're embryonic. Because if you're an adult, you have no embryonic tissues in your body other than that tumor, unless you're pregnant. So now you have an opportunity to go after these cells with great selectivity, because now you're just targeting the embryonic expression pattern. So the trick now is to be able to grab the cells that are undergoing the morphogenetic movement, and at that moment determine what their gene expression pattern is, to see if it's really distinctive. And if it distinguishes them from tumor cells that are not undergoing this morphogenetic movement pattern, and distinguishes them from normal cells that are also in the same tissue. And that has been done. So machines have been built to collect these tumor cells as they migrate into these streams, and just grab them as a live population, measure their phenotypes in vitro, and then do gene expression pattern analysis on them. And what pops out are a series of four pathways that basically are responsive in their activation to EGF, which is one of the cytokines that drives this process of morphogenesis.
A protein.
EGF stands for epidermal growth factor. So it's an epithelial growth factor that determines the activation and growth of normal glands. So it's no surprise it would be involved in tumor growth and spreading. But these pathways work off of the EGF signaling pathway. They work directly off of the receptor. And it turns out that one of the proteins that binds directly to the receptor that's uniquely upregulated in these migratory tumor cells is the protein MENA, standing for mammalian ENA. And so we looked at this protein in detail because it's regulating the receptor signaling directly, and found that the form of MENA that was being expressed in the migratory tumor cells was different from the form of MENA that was being expressed in the non-migratory tumor cells. And it was, again, different from the normal cells in the tissue. And so it looked like it was only being turned on in the tumor cells that were migrating. And so we were really struck by this. And we went back and looked at this in some detail with our collaborator, Frank Gertler, who discovered this family of proteins, and found that the form of MENA that was being expressed uniquely in the migratory tumor cells was the embryonic form, which distinguished these cells now from all of the other cell types that are in that same tissue at that moment, which express the adult form of MENA. And the embryonic form of MENA has an extra exon in it, which can be identified by PCR or with antibodies and could be a drug target. So now you have your magic bullet target. If you can make a drug that can basically stop the version of the protein that has that embryonic MENA exon in it, you could stop what's special about those cells in terms of their signaling from the EGF receptor. So that's how you get to a magic bullet.
So you're not targeting all tumor cells, you're targeting the tumor cells which would go on to spread around the body.
That's right. So you're not killing tumor cells by stopping them from growing. What you're doing is you're stopping the tumor cells from spreading.
Right, because of course it's the spreading tumor cells that kills people.
That's right.
Now, this seems like a very ancient sort of pathway, the interaction between the macrophages and the tumor cells. You say it's involved in the formation of the normal human breast. And is it also involved in embryogenesis?
Yes, this particular isoform of MENA, this embryonic MENA, is seen in embryonic development of the brain, in neurons, and in glandular tissue, colon, breast, and so on. So the five solid tumors that plague humans at this time in history are all adenocarcinomas, which means epithelially derived tumors, and all the adenocarcinomas that are undergoing metastasis are, we believe, have to express this form of MENA to do it. It's going to be a common characteristic of all of these adenocarcinomas.
And this form of MENA, is it turned on by the interaction with the macrophages?
No, it's not. That's interesting. It's turned on by the tumor microenvironment. The tumor microenvironment generates signals that cause certain embryonic, the factors that turn on genes, the so-called transcription factors like ZEB, TWIST, SNAIL, These are well known. They're given those names because they were discovered in lower organisms, and they have particular, when you play with these transcription factors, they generate particular shapes in the mutant flies or the mutant worms. And so they're given those names, like twist, right? The embryo is all twisted up. So these are the cytokine-dependent transcription factors that regulate embryonic gene expression. And these transcription factors get turned on by microenvironmental signals in the embryo. Well, it turns out that the tumor is generating these kinds of cytokine signals that turn on these embryonic transcription factors. Those, in turn, turn on the expression of the embryonic MENA.
Okay, and how is it that certain tumor cells get turned on and others don't? Is differences in their particular microenvironments?
Yeah, it probably depends on where you're standing. If you happen to be in a region where the tumor is growing rapidly and it's not generating any embryonic-like cytokine signals, then you'll just sit there and you'll be a rapidly growing epithelial cell, tumor cell. But if you happen to be standing in a region where the cytokine signals are being turned on that mimic this embryonic stimulatory package, because it's not just one factor, it's probably a whole mixture of cytokines that turn on this particular pattern of growth factors, then you get the full shot of information. And when these transcription factors come on, you actually begin to turn on these embryonic genes that then make these embryonic proteins. And that's probably what's going on. Now, you're going to ask me a question, how I'll anticipate it. The embryonic MENA is not a different protein from MENA. So it's not just a matter of you're expressing protein A versus protein B. No, MENA is a protein, and you can make it as an adult form or as an embryonic form. And the way you do that is by doing differential gene splicing. So what's really going on here is you're differentially splicing the gene from an adult form to an embryonic form. And that's the tricky part, because that means that there's no way to attack this phenomenon. This protein is not unusual. It's just a slight rearrangement of the gene product that's causing this phenomenon. So this is a recent invention after the lowest eukaryotes to be able to splice mRNAs to generate multiple versions of a protein called isoforms. And these multiple isoform patterns, they're never in isolation. If you have one gene undergoing a splicing of its mRNA, it's usually linked to 20 or 30 other genes. So these whole patterns, their cassettes, come on together. So the activation of one twist transcription factor generates a whole cassette of splicing patterns. And these genes now that are spliced in the embryonic form work together for a period of time, generate a shape, and then they go away.
You've just shown some amazing movies where you have a tumor cell sitting around doing not very much, and then you have a macrophage on its own sitting around not doing very much, but put them together, mm-hmm. and they whiz together, and then they line up.
That's right. So the ability of the tumor cell and macrophage to interact and sustain that interaction to lead to a productive amplified migration pattern is autonomous to these cells. You can actually put these cells in isolation together, and they will interact, and they'll generate these rather very high-speed streams or trains of cells moving. And this is unexpected, because the expectation we had actually imaging the behavior of these cells in tissue was that the microenvironment would have to be present to sustain this cell interaction throughout its functional lifetime. And the reality is, it looks like all you have to do is get the two cell types together and have the tumor cell expressing this embryonic pattern. And after that, the cells are completely autonomous. So they can leave the microenvironment that generated that pattern of interaction and pattern of gene expression and be independent of it now. And that's fascinating. You know, that's really, that also indicates the danger of the disease, is that you can generate a change in these cells and they'll maintain it even after they leave their local environment.
As you say, it's fascinating. And here you've got this most amazing slide. This is a bud in the normal breast tissue development. What's going on?
Well, the terminal end bud is invading the fat, which is otherwise acellular. I mean, it's got fat cells in it, but it doesn't have any of the parenchyma of the gland in it. And what that terminal end bud is doing is it's crawling, being pulled. All of these things are going on simultaneously to pull that long string of epithelial cells out a great distance into the actual fat pad to form a glandular tree
So this would be the normal milk
this
gland.
This is the normal milk gland. So here, for example, just to orient you, is the nipple is way down here. And these strands of epithelial cells have moved out this far into the mammary fat pad, which is otherwise empty. And as you can see, these distances are huge. This is millimeters. These glands have pulled out, and they're like a tree occupying the fat. And each one of these fingers or epithelial strands has a tip on it called the terminal end bud, and that's where the action is, where all this force for migration is being generated by these macrophages.
So you can just see very vividly here just how important they are.
It's remarkable. What this illustrates is how important it is not to look at dead biology. If you actually go and watch the embryo form, I think you'll see all of the various forms of cancer recapitulated.
So do you think that there should be much more interaction between embryologists and cancer biologists and developmental biologists?
I think it's key to have the embryologists, the mammalian embryologists, and the cancer biologists working in parallel. It's more important than any other possible multidisciplinary interaction at this point of time. If you're interested in how cancer stem cells generate tumors, the rules by which tumors grow, and the rules by which tumors disseminate and metastasize, it's absolutely crucial to have embryologists and cancer biologists working together. And they have to be mammalian embryologists. I'm not talking about somebody studying sea urchin, because the rules that are being followed are species-specific. And obviously, you know, developmentally, they're in a very narrow window. So you don't want to look at organisms that are great model organisms for development but aren't mammals. You're going to get the wrong answer. Or even dramatically diverse mammalian species. You really want to get something close to human. So mouse is good. Mouse works. I think that's an urgent need. I think it's a greatly overlooked need right now.
Well, thank you very, very much for talking to me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.